The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Amy Edmondson. Amy is the Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at the Harvard Business School. She's been recognized by the biannual Thinkers 50 Global Ranking of Management Thinkers since 2011, teaches and writes on leadership, teams, and organizational learning. Her articles have been published in the Harvard Business Review and California Management Review, Administrative Science Quarterly, and the Academy of Management Journal. She is the author of Teaming, How Organizations Learn, Innovate, and Compete in the Knowledge Economy, as well as Teaming to Innovate. She has a new book. It's called The Fearless Organization, Creating Psychological Safety in the Workplace for Learning, Innovation, and Growth. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I had a speaking date recently where I offered the idea that in the future, the most important division in any business will be human resources. And in the introduction to your book, you write, quote, creating value starts with putting the talent you have to its best and highest use. So I might not be that far off. HR is going to be maybe important in the future.
I completely agree. I mean, HR may play, you know, the most strategic role in the future because the more you're in a knowledge business, the more you're playing in a knowledge industry, the more the resources you actually have are the people. So how do we put them to their best use? That's sort of the big challenging problem.
Yeah, and so one of the chapters is titled Underpinnings, and I'm going to quote from that. You say, quote, our spontaneous tendency to discount the future explains the prevalence of many unhelpful and unhealthy behaviors. So what are we doing when we discount this future? How is that unhelpful and unhealthy?
Well, what we're doing is for example, at work, in a hospital, I might be a nurse. I might have a concern about, is that the right medication? But, you know, you're the doctor, you know better. So I pause. I don't say something. And part of the reason I don't say something is I remember what you did to me last time I questioned an order. You know, you made me feel like an idiot. So I'm discounting the future because in that moment, I'm overvaluing the importance of your potential scorn and undervaluing what might happen a day or an hour or, you know, 2 weeks from now because that patient didn't get the right medication. So, you know, we're often when we're holding back because of some little feeling of, oh, I won't look good or you won't like me or you might be angry at me, and so I hold back, I'm completely distorting the importance of your reaction and minimizing the importance of that potential contribution I was going to make.
Yeah, and the problem isn't just that there is silence. You write in the book, quote, silence when voice was possible rarely announces itself. A lovely turn of phrase,
right.
But it's also like, oh, wow, that's a big problem because the silence is not, because it's not spoken, you don't even know the possibility. It's not just that there might be a mistake, but you're also maybe losing a great idea.
It's invisible. So there are two kinds of risks. You know, risk one is by my not speaking up, the organization or the patient or the business might be at risk. You know, I might have been about to point out a real safety concern or a real risk. The other risk is that I might have had the million-dollar idea, but I was worried that you might, you know, laugh at me, so I held back. You know, so one is a kind of, risk of not averting an avertible failure, and the other is the risk of the innovation opportunity that we never even knew we had. But in both cases, my silence is invisible. Right? In both cases, the act of not speaking hasn't been observed by anybody except the person who held back.
All right. And this, I'm gonna take you back on this, because I first came across your work when you were part of a large team studying medical errors in several hospitals. And it was that work that was absolutely foundational to Second City developing an Improvisation for Caregivers program, which we're about 2 years into. And the origin story of your research is so fascinating. And I'm just, can you talk a little bit about that particular study?
Sure. So I was part of this large study to investigate the incidence of medical errors. And I was asked to be a part of the study because I was a team's researcher. So the idea was, you know, the medical folks were going to collect data on error rates and how they differed across hospital units or, you know, unit-based teams. And my job was to assess the teams as teams, you know, how good was the teamwork? How good was the leadership? How engaged and collaborative were people and so on? So I did that. And, of course, my hypothesis was the better teams would make fewer errors. I mean, it's not even interesting. It's so obvious, right? And so all I hoped was that there'd be enough variance that I'd be able to show that. And then, you know, fast forward, the medical investigators spent 6 months kind of tried painstakingly going unit to unit trying to get those error rates. And I spent much less time than that getting survey measures of these teams. And lo and behold, it first looked like good news because there was, in fact, a significant correlation between the error rates and the team attributes. And then I looked more closely and realized it was in the wrong direction. Right? Mm-hmm. Like what the data seemed to be saying was that better teams make more mistakes, not fewer. Now, that just didn't seem right, but it was a pretty kind of disturbing result at first glance. So I sat down to think, and I suddenly thought, wait a minute, maybe they aren't making more mistakes. Maybe they're just more willing and able to talk about mistakes. Like maybe they're more sort of alert to the complexity of healthcare, and they recognize that they need to be talking, they need to be improving. So to make a long story short, I couldn't just say, oh, that's what's happening and leave it at that. I had to send a kind of research assistant into the teams, unaware of what the team measures said, unaware of what the error measures said, and ask him to just kind of size them up. You know, how do they differ? What are these teams like? And ultimately what we were able to see is that they varied enormously in terms of the openness of how they talked, especially how they talked about error and how comfortable they were speaking up and raising these issues. So later, much later, I called that difference psychological safety. But at the time, I simply was glad to hear there were real differences. And then I said, well, do you think you could kind of rank order the units, the teams, you know, from most open to most closed? And he said yes, and did. And that ranking was nearly perfectly correlated with the actual error rate. Wow. In other words, you learn what they let you learn. So yeah. It began to seem very plausible that climate differences between these different work groups, in fact, was explaining, you know, was predicting and explaining the error rates. So that I realized they weren't getting actual error rates, even though they were trying. They were getting sort of detected error rates. They were finding out only about those errors that were findoutable.
Yeah. The correlation between that and improvisation is really all around fear. So one of the things that we do with very beginning improvisers is we recognize that, you know, you're up there and you're in front of people and you're making something out of nothing, which is kind of how we all live every day. But right. You know, literally on stage, the one thing that will contribute to you failing to improvise well is if you're in your fear brain. So we have all these exercises around sort of putting your focus on others and deep listening. listening, but also in the training, this element of using your failures and making mistakes work for you and seeing all obstacles as gifts. And really, it's this practice that we put people through that says, look, you just failed on stage in front of everyone and you're still standing. And guess what? That's how we live every day. And as you become, you sort of flex that muscle more and more, you're able to try more. You're able to sort of survive. It's kind of like it's not only sort of reducing fear. It's like getting rid of shame. And so much at your work when you talk about psychological safety is this fight against the fear. And you go so far as to say literally fear inhibits learning.
Absolutely. Especially inhibits shared learning, like collective learning or team-based learning. Because if it leads us to hold back, if it means we're not speaking up and we're not asking for help or sharing our ideas or sharing our observations, then we're not learning. And not only am I not learning, but we aren't learning. So it's a real waste. But I love what you just described because it's so parallel. I mean, if you aren't, and there is a certain, you know, it's great that it's improv because there is a certain way in which positive humor really helps, you know, because what we're talking about in a way is, and this will come out wrong, but you can't take yourself too seriously.
Right.
I mean, and I don't mean that you don't matter. You matter enormously, but when you take yourself too seriously, then you're locked out of being able to make the contribution that you can make.
Well, you got to, and the taking yourself, you have to take yourself as a human. And this is, and if you're a human, you are a failure machine. So, I just talked to Dolly Chugg, who's got this terrific new book around bias, and she makes this analogy to, many people are hung up on diversity and inclusion issues. And she goes, why don't you just think about it like tech? You know, tech is constantly being upgraded and, you know, it's like we're not using floppy disks anymore. And why don't you think about your diversity and inclusion muscle the same way? But that really goes to what you're studying and talking about, too, which is we are works in progress. And when you can when you can approach that, and this isn't total improv thing, it's a much healthier way to walk through the world.
Right. And I would even say it's healthier and happier.
Yeah.
Because if you think of yourself as a work in progress, and I love that frame, then you are becoming. Right? I'm in the process of becoming, and I'm becoming better, and I'm becoming more who I am, which is a lovely thing. Right?
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to be there yet, and by definition, each and every one of us is a fallible human being.
Yep.
That's just, you know, hasn't yet been a human being that isn't a fallible human being. So get over it, right? Learn to love it. Learn to embrace it and share it. Be open about it.
Well, and
I am, we all are.
Exactly. And you know, the reason that so much funny stuff comes out of improvisation, because improvisation itself is not, you know, comedy. Comedy comes from it because improvisation reveals truth. And the funny stuff is usually, and surprise, right? And the funny stuff is usually the errors. No one is laughing at your story of how your vacation went well. No one wants to hear that. What they want to hear is, what was the fiasco? And then we can all relate to it. And I think we should probably talk specifically about psychological safety because, hugely, you know, it's part of so many people talk about this, but I think people confuse this a lot and think it's just about being nice. And that's not at all what psychological safety is.
Not at all. In fact, you could almost say it's the opposite. Not that it's not about being mean, but it's the problem is that so often when we think we're being nice or when we talk about being nice, what we really mean is, I'm not going to tell you what I really think. And, you know, so I'm going to say a nice thing about your idea during the meeting, but then in the hallway later to my close colleague, I'm going to say, God, that was the stupidest thing I ever heard. The reality is that's not nice, you know, because if I happen to overhear that, it's anything but nice. So, you know, holding back and being polite isn't nice. Now, I'm not saying go out and, you know, rip and be mean. I'm saying you have to be, you have to kind of hold yourself accountable for finding a way to say clearly what you think. And by the way, what you think might not be right, right? Mm-hmm. It's only your perspective. So we have to be willing to share our perspectives with each other, recognizing the whole time that our perspectives are by necessity limited, you know, partial perspectives. And just, you know, we got to be willing to be candid because too much is at stake.
Yeah. My friend Kim Scott, who wrote the book Radical Candor, talks about the fact that, you know, you can't really be radical candid unless the person across from you knows that you love them.
It's wonderful.
I know this to be true, and I know this of myself, that I tended to fall more in the quadrant of what she calls ruinous empathy, which is I care so much I'm not going to say anything, because it's going to make all of us uncomfortable.
Right.
And this is such a core element to the way psychological safety operates in the group, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. it's not enough just to say, I have an open door, you know, as a boss. It's
right.
like you have to message over and over and over again that it's okay to say the wrong thing, that you need to model mm-hmm. those behaviors. And again, over and over, because otherwise we're going to lapse back into our default behavior, which is maybe to say nothing and do nothing.
Right. And that's easier.
It is.
It's natural. It's, you know. It's the default, but it isn't the way you ever do anything great.
Yeah. We were talking before the podcast, too, about, as any listener of the podcast knows, because I've talked about it, my daughter's in the hospital now. So I'm there all the time. I'll be there tomorrow. What I have discovered, drawing a bit on your work and others, is that building relationships between my entire caregiving team has just dramatic effect on the quality of my healthcare, because I think it is that. And this isn't just like me talking to the doctor. It's my daughter. It's my wife. It's my nurse. It's my doctor. It's the administrator. Mm-hmm. It's the Walgreens that's there that's getting a prescription, because invariably mm-hmm. there's mistakes. And the right. ability that we've got to be able to say, hey, I think you mentioned this dosage and it came out as this. No one is playing gotcha, and I find then that we have a much more ability to sort of cruise through those moments and just sort of learn from them and fix them for the next visit, because guess what? There's going to be a mistake the next visit as well.
Exactly. It's healthcare by its nature is a complex, error-prone system.
Yeah.
That means you got to assume that things will go wrong. Doesn't mean someone screwed up. Doesn't mean someone's to blame. It means assume something go wrong. So we're all detectives, right? We're treasure hunters. We're going to find the treasure of what went wrong so we can fix it before the patient gets harmed by it.
Yeah. And interesting, Nick Epley at University of Chicago was talking to me about this a couple months ago, where he was sort of saying, you know, people think they can read a room, and he doesn't mm-hmm. see the evidence on that. He goes, here's the evidence I have. If you really want to find something out, ask a lot of questions. And I've noticed
right.
that the really experienced nurses and doctors will ask Nora a lot of different questions about her pain, because she doesn't know. She's 16 years old, or any of us.
She's
like,
never been here before.
How
yeah.
do you describe your pain with a, you know, so, but they ask over and over, and usually that arrives at a point that looks like, oh, okay, I might understand this better because I've really sort of gotten in there. And also, this idea of knowing and seeing the other person, which comes up in a lot of the research I read, which is we have such a strong desire as human beings to be seen as we see ourselves, that, that creates a whole other level of relationship that I think, again, contributes to the more positive aspect of our care.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and you're right. I mean, the centrality of the good question, and the, you know, the great clinicians are the ones who are asking good questions routinely.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important.
Yeah. So we should talk about some of the stories that you've got in the book about organizations, and you learn through your failures. We've talked about that. So let's talk about some. I just ended my lease on my Volkswagen Passat. I had driven a VW car for years, but I ended up switching to a Honda, and it's in no small part because of what we learned about Volkswagen a few years ago. So you might want to remind people, like, VW was the largest car maker in the world, right?
It was for a while, yes.
So,
and part of that was because of its very great successes in the U.S. market. And part of its very great success in the U.S. market mm-hmm. was because it was selling this so-called green diesel vehicle that, you know, a lot of people found quite attractive to buy a green diesel vehicle. The reality was that the technology of the diesel engine just wasn't there yet. It wasn't there yet in terms of great for power and all that, but it was not able to pass the emissions. And as many listeners will recall, the company strategy absolutely depended on this vehicle and on this vehicle passing emissions. And the CEO was the kind of leader who people were absolutely terrified to bring him bad news. They were terrified to meet with him. He was insistent that this goal be met, right? This car had to pass the emissions test. Well, you know, what are you going to do? You're racked by fear. You can't give him bad news. Turns out they figured out what to do. They designed software to fool the regulators, basically mm-hmm. software to fool the regulatory machines. You have to, I mean, almost talk about empathy. You almost have to have empathy to imagine what these engineers must have been feeling and thinking that it made sense to them to design cheating software rather than simply report the bad news. This technology isn't able to pass these tests. Right? It's crazy in a way mm-hmm. because what we know from history and what we know from all history is that eventually it will come out. You can cheat, you can have a massive organized fraud, but eventually it will come and hit the cold light of day, and that will be so much worse than falling slightly short on your magnificent strategy. So, you know, in that story and in so many others, as a leader, you've got to force yourself to want the bad news. You've got to force yourself to be all ears. I like to say that, you know, a recipe for disaster is stretch goals. Now, I'm all for stretch goals, but mm-hmm. stretch goals plus closed ears. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have stretch goals, you better have open ears, because it's like, okay, let's go for gold, and what are you seeing? What are you learning? What's working? What isn't? Because we're going to have to be the people who are, you know, learning really fast and really effectively if we want to achieve those stretch goals.
That's interesting. My boss at Second City for years, Andrew Alexander, I used to joke with people. It's like, you know, I'm a very glass half full guy. Andrew's not mm-hmm. Andrew's not glass half empty. He's like, there's no glass. He's fine. Like, he somewhat revels in the bad news. He's interested yeah. in it.
Right. And,
but that creates
he
a
knows co- it's there.
It's there. Like, it's probably he's like
it's
he
coming.
Always we're always about to close, even though we've been massively successful yeah. forever. So the one thing that does, though, is that creates this a great deal of psychological safety around talking about what could go wrong, right? And so
yes,
as long
yes.
as you maintain that balance as well of keeping people so that they understand there's purpose and meaning, but, you know, because we're talking again about another kind of silence, and that silence that comes from management by fear. And then what that seems to also do to people is create this place where they can basically tell themselves a story that avoids responsibility. Because that happened at Wells Fargo. That happened at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I mean, you have count nuclear reactors in Japan. I mean, it's amazing.
Nokia.
Yeah.
It happens. If it were a unique story, it wouldn't be. It would be interesting, but it wouldn't be the basis of a book like this. The reasons why these are important stories is that they unfortunately happen over and over and over. And they're crazy, right? Mm-hmm. And it's nobody wants to find themselves the subject of a scandal that's headline news for weeks.
Yeah.
Nobody wants that outcome. And yet, they haven't done what it takes to avoid that outcome. And if you're dealing in the realm of uncertainty and innovation and novelty, then you better make a space where people know their full voice is welcome.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have silence, and we want people to use their voice. Another theme that I see in your book and some of the other interviews I've had recently is this idea around the fact that words matter. And we know this in our work because we have this whole idea around yes and, which is like, to improvise well, you can't say no, you have to say yes and. And it's really, it's almost like, it doesn't matter if you're really thinking a no. If you're forced enough to say yes and, you are going to be in a yes and mindset. And you talk about places like Uber, who have sort of core values and language that might be a bit unhealthy. You also tell the story around Julie Morath at the Children's Hospital in Minneapolis, who introduces new terminology that altered the meaning of events and actions in important ways. So digging a little bit underneath this is like, what is going on that these words make such a difference the way they're used?
Words are the software, you know, the code, the programming of our thinking. And so words shape our thinking. I mean, they shape our meaning making, you know, and some words are just sort of scary words, like, you know, failure. And by the way, I'm not anti-using that word, but error, mistake. Those are words that make me feel shame, that make me feel fear. And so for example, what Morath did is instead of the word error, she wanted to use the word accident, because 95% of the things that go wrong are not a single error. They're not a single person screwing up. There's sort of a whole confluence of things going wrong that people didn't recognize fast enough. So using the word accident instead of the word failure or mistake is a really powerful thing. But the words we use shape our thinking, which shapes our behaving, you know, which shapes our results. So we got to get them right. We got to get them so that they convey the meaning that we really want them to convey. That's why yes and is so powerful. But, you know, anytime you stick but into the middle of a sentence, it negates everything that came before. And we know that, but we sometimes can't, we miss it. Like, I'm going to say, well, you know, that was a really good program, but then you sort of, you know, lost me. Well, what did you just hear? It wasn't a good program.
Right. Yeah, our phrase on that is yes, but is no with a bow tie. You know, you get the gratitude up top, and then, afterwards, that's... And so, I mean, this is... You're talking about the sort of national conversation that's going on now in America in the time in which we live, sitting here in 2018, right? And I think back to, Stephen Colbert was in my very first cast at Second City, and he was my wife's roommate at Northwestern. So Stephen is a good friend. And I think back to, you know, a decade ago where he had this idea around truthiness, which was a word for the fact that we're... you know, not using words correctly, or it is right, almost like
right. I almost prescient, right?
It was and
crazy.
I had this there was a phrase that someone said, if it can't be used for evil, it's not a superpower. And I always love that, because that's what this is, right? You're saying these words are a superpower, and therefore they can be weaponized, and that's what's happening.
Right, that's what's happening. Fake news, that's a weapon.
Yep. And it muddies the truth is a tough word, I guess, to use. It removes context. It eliminates nuance. And
there are facts.
Yeah. Every day it becomes harder that way. Okay, we're coming close to the end, and I'm going to ask you if you have a yes and story, but I did want to ask you another question in terms of just getting at the root of psychological safety. So we've had people on the podcast who talk about like different personality types, extroverts and introverts. And I'm wondering, are there individual behavior traits themselves that inform psychological safety in the group? Or is it really about this organizational group first and individual later?
It is really about the group Right. So there are individual differences, and one individual difference is there's a factor called neuroticism. The more, you know, the higher you score on the neuroticism scale, the more likely you are to not feel psychologically safe. Now, that makes sense, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you sort of think the world's out to get you, so you're not safe.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, it's not correlated. Your experience of psychological safety at work is not correlated with extroversion, introversion. And the reason is, you know, extroversion, the reason is that it describes something emergent about the group or the team. You know, the few of us have been working together for a while, and this just starts to feel like a place where I can be myself, where I can ask for help, where I can point to a mistake and feel I won't be penalized for it. Or this feels like the kind of place where no way, I just can't do it. I hold back. I, you know, design the software. I don't speak up about the error. So it just tends to be the emergent property that comes out of a bunch of little things that have happened that I've made sense of. And, you know, I just sort of draw the inference that it's safe or not very safe around here. And if you ask a number of individuals to fill out a survey to assess this, they will tend to have pretty strongly correlated responses. You know, so we'll give very similar responses, even though we're very different people. Because we all can recognize, yep, this is a safe place or this is an unsafe place. And that those groups, that climate at the kind of group level will vary a lot between groups, even in the same organization. So it's not really a hospital level phenomenon. It's a unit level phenomenon in the hospital.
Yeah. So 100%. And I see this at Second City as well, because our sort of main stage company, the group of six actors who develop their show, are so protected and in such a psychologically safe environment with regard to, I mean, when I was running the theater, you know, I had to ask permission if I wanted to come through the room while they were rehearsing or even come see a show when they were in process, because I didn't want to have like executive eyes when they were still kind of just, you know, meandering.
Yes.
Or searching. And this was just kind of a known thing, and this is how Second City was built. And, you know, we end up looking at that and going, oh, great, we can teach this to other organizations. But even in our own organization, we don't always apply it as a business.
Mm-hmm.
We call each other out, you know, we have a North Star. I don't think most businesses are oriented in terms of thinking about the group first. They always go back to like, well, this person, you know, they don't work hard. It's always a performance issue.
Yes.
Yeah, right?
We're so, you know, so socialized to think, oh, it's someone's fault, you know, or it's an individual who did this or did that. We don't really take seriously those emergent group level phenomena.
Yeah, so important. Okay, I could talk to you forever, I'm gonna ask you if you have a personal yes and story. So the idea here, of course, in improvisation is you can't get anywhere by saying no, and as we've already talked about, you can't say yes, but you have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if there's been a time in your work or your life where you were going to say no, but instead you chose to do a yes and.
And do you have? You don't have to say it aloud. So.
No,
in your
you
question,
do not,
you, said,
you do not have to
okay.
say that.
Then I think I have a good one.
Okay.
So long ago, when I was a young engineer working for Buckminster Fuller, who was, you know, a great American, you know, visionary inventor, architect, but really an engineer who designed a lot of remarkable structures. And I had only been working for him for about 6 weeks, and he spent a lot of time traveling, so I really didn't know him very well. I only had intersected with him, you know, a handful of times in the office. And I was on my way out the door, and he said, now I had studied engineering, but I hadn't done any drawing, any technical drawing. And he said, on my way out the door, he had some work that had to be done. And you have to understand, I had been spending the last 6 weeks like photocopying, because I was the new kid on the block, and everybody was just giving me everything, you know, that nobody else wanted to do. And I'm the only person on the in the organization at the time. There's about seven or eight people working there. I'm the only one with engineering training. And so he suddenly sees me, and he suddenly is sort of aware who I am, and he says, "You know how to do technical drawing, don't you?" Now, the true answer was no.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I said, yes. And in my head, I thought, yes, and I am heading to the public library right now to get a book on this topic, and I am going to darn well teach myself how to do this, or I'll be photocopying for the rest of my life.
Oh, my God. So
and
did
I
you,
did.
You did.
But then, you know, fast forward, like a few days later, I'd done the drawings, and I brought them in. I thought, okay, now I'm going to get fired because it's going to be so clear that I'm a fraud and I didn't do it right or something. And I brought him the drawings, and he said, "Ah, very good. Now do these," you know, and on it went, and the rest was history.
I can't believe you got to work for Buckminster Fuller. That's amazing.
I know. I can't either. Sometimes I think about it and I go, did that really happen?
Yeah.
Yes, it did.
That's amazing.
He was a dear. He was a gem.
Oh, was he? That's actually nice to know. That.
Oh, my gosh. He was the most joyful, curious, wonderful person I've ever known. You know, just he loved life. He never stopped learning. He just was full of possibility.
Oh, that's terrific. The book is called The Fearless Organization. Amy Edmondson, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Well, I've been working in a coal mine.